Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Matt Drinkon. Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Eternal Optimist podcast, where today we are going to spread some hope. We're going to share some story that you might find some inspiration in, you might find some emotion in. At the very least, you might find some entertainment in as we get into it, because I've been talking to my guest today, Shane, for the last few minutes, and he's just a pure delight. And in fact, in our first few minutes of the conversation, I may have just agreed to switch to him as my IT service provider and my web design company. He's likable and he's got the reputation. And you'll see, we'll talk about the website. We'll talk about his business today, probably in the second half of our show. But the first half, we just got some amazing stories going to come your way. I want to introduce to you our guest for today, Mr. Shane Skwarek. Shane, how are you today, sir?
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here. I thank you for having me on. It's an honor, honestly, and I'm doing great.
Yeah, cool, man. He lives up here in one of these Manawa, all these Jersey cities that are near the coast that start with M-A-N-A. Which one are you in? I don't know how to say it.
I'm in Manahawkin. If you travel up the Garden City Parkway, which is how you determine where somebody's from, New Jersey, you've got Manasquan, which is north of me, and then north of Manasquan is Manalapan. And there's probably a dozen more like that. New Jersey likes to name things very similar. We have a Belmar and then a Belmore, which is just adds a W in there. It's just how things go. We have three ocean townships in New Jersey, all in different counties. So you have to describe it by counties. So somebody decided that they were maybe hitting the bottle a little hard when they started naming areas of our state.
Yes. Awesome. Well, Shane, just give us some context here for our listeners. If they know you, then they definitely know you. But if they don't know you, then tell us, what are just a couple of things, like where do you live? How old are your family, business? Just give us some context as we dive in.
Yeah. So Manahawkins at the New Jersey shore, often confused with the TV show of the same name. I promise you all, we're not fist pumping all the time, at least not all of us, at least not anymore. So yeah, I mean, born and raised in New Jersey, we've kind of really acclimated to the beach life here. I'm a father of two young kids. I have a beautiful wife, Melina, 38 years old. Haven't always worked for myself, but I've spent the better part of my life having done that. I think I fully ventured out on my own in about 2012 was when I separated from my last full-time job. But I was doing some of my own stuff before that. I found my niche sort of working with small businesses and nonprofits, primarily as a technology consultant. And really what that means is my entry to a lot of businesses is on the web design side. Easy skill to market to businesses because most of them think they need one. And then from there, what I do is I'll go in and I like to talk to the business owners or, you know, aspiring entrepreneurs and just sort of learn about what their business is and then see, you know, are there ways that we can use technology to kind of increase your efficiency, primarily in operations. So can we automate a process? Can we throw up a POS system in your storefront that connects to your website where maybe somebody can leave an online order and you don't have to worry about picking up the phone all day long? Things like that. And that's where our business sort of allows us to evolve just beyond that face of the business on the website side.
Can you see, like, listeners already? He's really easy to talk to. That was incredibly easy. He's not salesy at all. It was just really easy. So thank you for giving us some context, Shane. And what's your favorite hobby? Outside of course, serving your family and playing with your kids, what do you do for fun when you're not working and being a parent?
Oh, that's kind of a loaded question because I actually genuinely enjoy what I do. Yeah. And so a lot of my hobbies really do focus around the computer. I'm on the computer a lot, and that's in my personal time too. Outside of the development work and coding and things like that, I got really big into video games as a kid, kind of latched on to that later in life. Mm-hmm. So I found a lot of hobbies in, you know, creating 3D figures, learning how to animate them, using AI to kind of create some different images, which of course translate into business. Outside of a lot of the computer stuff, big New York Giants fan. So I was fortunate to I bought season tickets a couple of years ago. Of course, the team has been terrible ever since, you know, coincidentally.
Coincidentally, yes.
You know, it had nothing to do with the fact that I'm going to more games, even though historically most of the games I went to before being a season ticket holder, they lost. So a lot of my friends do blame me, advise me not to go to sell my tickets. Might take them up on it this year. Pro wrestling. It's a guilty pleasure for me. It's always been, I was big on it in the 90s. I mean, I started with the Hulk Hogan's and the Ultimate Warriors. The 90s, the whole Attitude Era was my favorite. I think everyone was. I held on through most of those years when everyone else sort of dropped off. I wasn't always active with it, but I just got to go to WrestleMania a couple weeks ago, which was really fun. I only went to one night. I couldn't physically bring myself. I bought tickets for both nights. I sold the night too. I would have loved to have been there, but it takes a lot out of you at this point. But it's been fun.
when you go to see wrestling, because I grew up a huge wrestling, and you're 9 years younger than me, so you named Hulk. Hulk has been pretty consistent for like since 1987, when I saw WrestleMania 3 in the Pontiac Silverdome in Detroit, Michigan.
Yeah.
I remember when he slammed Andre the Giant. He was like the biggest sensation in the whole world at that time. I mean, he had, what's the song? I'm a real American. Yeah. Who was that? That was Rick Derringer. Rick Derringer.
I could be completely wrong.
Yeah. Yep. So Hulk was the one, and I was always a big fan of Junkyard Dog, and he ended up making Harley Race bow to him at that WrestleMania. That was pretty interesting. Yeah. But so pro wrestling, you went to WrestleMania recently.
Yeah.
What is it that when you're there live, you can see and feel that you don't see when you're just watching on TV? Like, what's the difference?
It's incredible. And it's one of those things that I tell people all the time. You don't have to be a pro wrestling fan to go to a pro wrestling event and have a blast. My first experience was, I think it was maybe a neighbor or something. Somebody gave my father tickets and we went to a house show. And this is many, many years ago. I was a young kid. We were really close to the stage and we kind of got to walk out by the aisle. And I remember, you know, you saw the Hardy Boys at the time who were small on TV. Kane was big. Hardy Boys walk out and they're huge comparatively. I mean, Hardys are like 6'3", 6'4", which is a huge human being, but on television, they're tiny. Then Kane walks out. I just remember literally just like chills going down my spine. I'm staring at this guy. I mean, this is a monster human being. So, you know, flash forward to WrestleMania is you go in, and now this was in a small, I think it was Atlantic City Boardwalk Hall at the time when I first saw my first show. So you go from that small little arena, which I love, it's a great little spot to watch any show. And now you go, this was in Philly, which again, enemy territory as a Giants fan, but I sucked it up and I did for the greater good. Now you've just got, you know, however many, 70,000 people around there. And you can, as one person, say something, some kind of a chant and start a chant. And your section, the people around you start to rumble. The section grows, it rumbles more. And then the next thing you know, you have 70,000 people echoing what you said. And I'm not just being facetious when I say that. I remember when I've been to many shows over the years now. I remember being there when John Cena and Randy Orton were the two hottest acts. They were feuding. And that was when like the Cena sucks chant started. Let's go Cena sucks. And I remember being a part of that chant in our section. It was a handful of us that just started saying Cena sucks. And the whole world started doing it. Now, we weren't the ones that created it, but it was still in its infancy. So when you started saying it, people, it wasn't like automatic at that time. It was still kind of this grassroots, like organic thing. And like, I looked at my friends, we're like, oh my God, like we were part of saying that. Like we kind of started that chant with these other guys. Like that's what like the allure of wrestling. When you go to a football game or a concert, you know, people sing football games, you know, you got warring fans. When you're going to a wrestling event, everybody is there for one reason. They're all there for the same reason. And the energy is so infectious. You can't go there and hear all of these people, whether it's a 5,000 person building or a 70,000 person building. You can't not hear them going crazy. Like Jey Uso is one of the big guys right now for those that don't follow wrestling. And his whole stick when he comes out is going like this. You're on your feet and you're waving your hands as his song is playing. And you can't not do it because everybody is doing it. You got a grandma sitting down the row and she's doing it. It's just, to borrow a phrase from The Rock, it is electric. And it is just something that I encourage everyone to just try once. You could do some of the smaller shows like the no-name companies, the independents. Those are fun too. Try to go to a WWE. Even if it's a house show, it's fine. I just think that it's something you'll never experience anywhere else.
This is awesome. You've sent me down a rabbit hole. I'm on the WWE website right now looking for tickets somewhere near Charlotte, North Carolina.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah, this is super cool.
I'm such a fan of Hogan and a Real American that pretty recently, as like a fun little task for my staff, we wanted to create something that would be stupid and ridiculous for social media. So I hired a guy to rewrite Real American or re-sing it for me. I actually wrote the lyrics to Real American and it says, we are your web developers. So we recorded a music video, all just taking videos in our workstations, like we're distributed, everyone works remotely, distributed across the world. And so I had a guy literally, when I asked him that, I'm like, do you know the song Real American, Hulk Hogan's theme? He's like, yeah. I'm like, can you record that by yourself, but with my lyrics? He's like, oh my God. He's like, this is the most amazing thing I've ever been asked to do in my life. And he did it. He nailed it. The video is on our socials around. You could probably find it. I think it's tagged or pinned up there. It was so much fun. But my kids now, because they've heard it playing so much when I was doing a lot of the editing and stuff on the video, know that as the song. Like, they don't even realize that Real American's a song. There's, we are your web developers. That's what they're singing. It's amazing.
This is awesome. I just connected with you on LinkedIn, by the way, and I'm going to go on the rabbit hole later and find that video.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool to me. I'm a huge fan of Hulk Hogan and that song specifically. So this is good. Well, thank you for bringing us down the rabbit hole for wrestling. And before we go any further, I got to keep going here for a second, because you talked about as a kid growing up, you were in the video games. What system and what games are we talking about here, Shane?
Every system that you could probably imagine, I've cycled through at some point.
Like actually, N64, maybe? N64 GoldenEye?
Or we started all the way back on, well, it wasn't Atari, but we had what's called, oh gosh,
Coleco.
Odyssey.
Okay.
Similar.
Okay.
So you've heard, not a lot of people have heard of it. And then it was Nintendo 64 GoldenEye with my cousins. That was like right at that age. We weren't teens. We were sort of that preteen, and like the competition started roaring through your veins. GoldenEye spent way too many hours.
Oh, yeah.
Sega very briefly did a Dreamcast, but I became a PlayStation guy for many, many, many years. Big in the Final Fantasy world.
Yeah.
I loved that game. Resident Evil, the first one, just, I was a horror fan growing up too. So Resident Evil, playing that, I remember just one player, but my next door neighbors were great friends, and my brother, we'd all sit around and play this game, and we'd be just scaring the pants off ourselves. But it was so much fun. Later in life, I switched. I made the conversion to an Xbox, and that's where I've kind of rode out ever since.
Yes, sir. I'm with you. And literally, I'm with you, because that's what I have right now too, the Xbox. So good.
Most of my friends had it. I had no choice but to buy it. So that's why I ended up there.
Yes. Oh, so last question. Nintendo, old school, original Nintendo, top three games of all time.
That's hard. That's really hard.
Okay. You play with it, and I'll give you one for me. One of mine, for sure, is Super Dodgeball. Because I loved playing that game. That was my fun game that I would play it over and over and over again. So that was one.
Yeah.
Kid Icarus was one that brings back some good memories.
Okay.
That game. And then I'd say Tecmo Bowl was one that I played so much Tecmo Bowl. So
I got an appreciation for Tecmo Bowl later in life, because when I was playing Nintendo, I was still super young. So for me, it was really the Mario games were just, they were ubiquitous with the system. And with that, I remember we had Duck Hunt, and I loved it. And it's such like a cheesy game now in retrospect, but those were my two top favorites at that age. And then in like, as I kind of got a little older on Nintendo, Contra was always my go-to for my brother. We had a lot of two-player games, and that was the ultimate two-player game for us. And then it was like the Ninja Turtles and Zelda games, things like that. But if I had to go back and only play three, honestly, nostalgia brings me to Duck Hunt. Mario, I could just play endlessly forever. And for sure, Contra. Oh, okay. I downloaded the emulator on my Xbox because they re-released a bunch of old games. And I was sitting there trying to teach my kids how to play Contra. And they're like, what is this? Like, it's like pixelated. You can't even see anything. They couldn't be bothered.
Oh, man. Do you remember the cheat code to get 30 lives?
Oh, no, not off the test. It's not up, down, up, down, B, A, B, is it?
No, it's up, down, left, right, B, A, start, if I recall.
Left, right, B, A, start. Yep. Okay.
I was jaded forever once that Game Genie came out, and I thought this has got to be the coolest thing, and then I tried it on, and it was like the experience was very subpar. Yeah.
Yep.
I remember that.
Yep.
So, all right, well, this has been fun going down the memory lane here with video games and wrestling, and I think we might come back to AI in a little while. But before we do, I'd love to just kind of go to the normal format of our show. It's easy to talk to you about this stuff. It's easy to talk to you about your business. You're really good at that. What got you to a place where you are this successful in business? That is what I'd like to gift our listeners with, Shane. And through every successful leader, to get to that point, they had to overcome and endure things that may not be as obvious. It may not be something that someone would naturally just say, wow, Shane, he's that six. He overcame that. And maybe it's a little thing. Maybe it's a big thing. But to us, whatever's happening in our own lives, it's a challenge. It's the world to us. So I'd like to go back in your time somewhere. It could be from birth to yesterday, just anywhere where you've had some, what you would say are real challenges, difficulties in your life. And I'd like to ask you, what's the most difficult challenge that you're comfortable sharing with us today?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, and I know this is the eternal optimist, so I'm going to use this word carefully, but I think the way you can define success is by your failures. And I think a lot of people look at those hurdles or those failures as a negative, and I've always tried to embrace them. There's two moments that I can think of off the top of my head that were really defining for me, one of which is not necessarily, I guess neither of them are really considered a failure in the traditional sense, but it was such a mountain to overcome where it was easy to sort of submit into something else. The first for me was death of a parent. So back in 2007, I was about to graduate college, and it was the last week of my finals, and my father had been going through some cancer at the time, colon cancer.
Okay. How long had he had cancer? Is this like sudden or is it like prolonged?
It was probably just about a year time frame where his like diagnosis was heavy. It was probably a little bit longer than that, but give it about a year that he was really going under heavy treatments. And that was like the start and the deterioration for us was over the course of that year.
So you saw a deterioration of your father at a young age.
Oh yeah. And he's the type of person that would be very active, former police officer. His second career after he retired, he went and worked in a special needs school as their tech, well, first as a sub, then he became their technology person, big into computers, which obviously passed down to us. We had access to it all of our lives. At a young age, my father was building computers. At a young age, when Netflix first came out and they would mail you DVDs, my father...
Yes.
So my father always, we always had a Blockbuster in our house because my father would record HBO on cassette tapes and all VHSs. So, and label them. And so we always had a library of them in our house. So when people come over, like I never knew that it wasn't normal to have like 65, 70 movies at all times. Everyone else thought it was crazy. So when Netflix comes out, my father signs up for the Max subscription and we get the DVDs. He never watched them. He'd get them, he'd burn them, he'd put them back in the mail the same day. So we had a constant cycle of Netflix. So I'd have books and books of DVDs of every movie you could think of. It didn't matter what it was, but it's what he enjoyed doing. So I learned a lot of those tricks and trades from him. So as the cancer sets in, you know, again, very active. There's ponds all over the house, gardens outside, flowers. This is his life. He enjoys doing this stuff now. They say as you get older, you discover the outdoors more. I'm doing it myself now. All those things I thought my parents were crazy about, I'm literally out there gardening. My thumbs are green all the time.
Yes.
Right? That was the sad part of it. It's like you'd see him struggle a lot more with that. He couldn't tend to the ponds as much, and he started to just get weakened. Flash forward a little bit. He ends up passing on April 27th of 2007. The relevance of that period outside of obviously his passing is that that is the last week of my college career, not just that semester or that year. That's it. That's my finals to finish college. And the day we bury him is the last day of my last final. Subsequently, the very next day is an interview for a job that I was offered in New York City. And so my first big challenge now is I'm literally that day putting my father in the ground and we go to the repass. And now I have to decide, like, I have to go take a final. Do I do this? Do I try to get out of it? And I really had to rack my brain about it. And first parent loss, right? And probably the first real impactful death in my family. We've had other deaths, but I was a lot younger and I really didn't process them the same way. So they're probably the real first impactful one. I didn't really know how to kind of navigate through that. My mother was obviously besides herself. We have three younger siblings, so they were still in the picture. And I'm realizing now that like my role in the household has to change. And probably, I guess that would make me 20 at that age, somewhere around there, 19, 20.
Yeah. You graduated college in 4 years, so like 21, 22?
Right.
So 20, 21, 22, somewhere in there. Three younger siblings. Okay.
Yeah. You know what? No, because yeah, I would have been able to go out to the bars at that point. So yeah, absolutely. I probably was like 21, 22. You're right.
Yeah.
So yeah, my siblings were all 3 years underneath that. So my brother went in 3 years younger, my sister 3 years younger, then 2 years for my youngest brother. So all still in high school. My older of my younger siblings, the oldest of them, would have just been in his senior year. So he was getting ready to graduate. So again, we're going through all this. I'm realizing my role is going to have to change. And it's like, you know what? Like we're at the repass. I'm like, there's nothing more for me to do here today. Like there's nothing I'm going to get to college. I'm just going to go and just take this exam. Don't even care. That was my first real time that I had to myself too now. Of course, the exam I have to take is like a composition class, an English type class where you're writing every answer on the final is like essays. So I'm sitting there for 3 hours writing long form content, which I enjoy writing a lot, but it's just, of course, you're thinking and you're getting in your own head. So it was, I don't want to say traumatic, but it was a challenge to go over there. I may or may not have been tearing up. I don't remember. The whole thing was a blur to me. My professor gets wind of it because I think somebody in the class had said something and tells me, you need to leave. I'm like, no, just let me go. I passed the finals. I don't know if that was because I really did well or maybe he just gave me the sympathy pass. Don't know. Irrelevant, I guess, to the story. I end up taking the interview to that job the next day. My mother said the same thing. What's the difference? If you feel comfortable, go. I'm sure they'll understand if you say no. Screw it, I'm just going to go. There's an opportunity to work in Manhattan. It was a company that basically trains people to analyze stock market. I've been working on Wall Street, not as an analyst, but in technology. So I was like, I might not get this opportunity again. So I go in there. And then when I get to the interview, I realize, or I find out that the woman that I'm supposed to be working underneath has resigned. Okay, I've run the interview. Not only do they then later offer me the job, but they offer me her job. They're like, listen, we can hire somebody above you if it doesn't work out, but we'd like to give you the opportunity to take what her role was. I was coming in. She was eventually going to phase out over the next couple of years, decided I'm out now. I don't know why, never really asked. So there was a lot, obviously a lot to process in those moments.
Yeah.
I look back on it. Yeah. Well, it's going to get better too. Maybe not better in retrospect. So I look back on it and I ask myself, you know, was I pushing myself too hard to go through that? And maybe the answer to that is yes. Maybe I should have taken the initiative to kind of take a breath. For me, I've always defined that as like a testament to my character. I was able to kind of isolate those moments from my life and do what I thought was right. I know I had been speaking to my father a lot about this, about the end of school. He knew what my passions were. I was obviously doing it already a little bit. He helped me create my business. We created a sole proprietorship through college because I was doing web design while I was going through college. I didn't have a job. I was seeing my way through building websites at the time. Ridiculously cheap ones. So I was making a lot of them and working a lot of hours. But he saw that I was becoming entrepreneurial. He wanted me to be able to at least file that money in there. So he knew what I was going for. And he encouraged me, like, you know, get a job and you could always build your business on the side. And I thought it was going to be a disservice to him there. I get this job. I start working in New York City. The summer's about to kick in here. And at this point, I'm still lifeguarding in the summers, the Jersey Shore. Greatest job of all time. But I'm phasing myself out. I'm going to be working in the city and I'll just lifeguard on the weekends. A month to the day later, my mother's eldest sister, my aunt, drops dead.
Oh.
Collapses, goes into the hospital. Turns out she had cancer as well. She just didn't tell anybody because cancer happens to run in our family. She lost her brother. She lost her younger sister, my father. There's a lot of people in my family have passed from cancer. So now my mother, in the span of 30 days, literally 30 days, my aunt, to backtrack a little bit, didn't tell anybody because she did not want to go through chemo. And because she saw what it did to everybody else and just said, I'm just going to ride this out. Did not tell a soul except for, we think, maybe a guy she was dating at the time who she kept at arm's length, kept pushing him away. We never understood why. He later came and said, like, I had gotten wind that she was, but she told me she'll never speak to me again and blah, 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 if I ever said anything to you guys. In any case, now I'm faced with this, that my mother is in shambles now. I'm still commuting to New York City. And I'm just overwhelmed.
Wow.
I resign in a fit of emotion. I just write an email late one night to my company that I just started working with. I'm like, I have to put in my resignation. I can't come to the city anymore. I have to be home. They decline my resignation and they allow me to adjust my schedule and just work from home. And so in 2007, I started working from home 3 days a week. And that persisted until I resigned from that job in 2012. It was very heavy. It was very emotional. It was a lot to take on, especially as I sort of define my role now. Like, I had to go to my brother's graduation in favor of my father. When my sister was going to her proms and homecomings and stuff, that was me that was there. Many years forward, I walked my sister down the aisle. Like, there's a lot of things that I realized at that time that I had to take in. The reason I look at that story with fondness is because that happened in 2007. It's what, 2024 now. That company that I got that job with is still today my client, and I've not worked there since 2012. After I resigned my position because I wanted to build my own business, they said, we're going to keep you on as a consultant to transition to somebody else. And they never let me go. I've outlasted 3 executive directors, CEOs. I'm the longest tenured member of that staff. I have not worked there since 2012. And it's because they gave me the opportunity in a time where if I had said no, maybe that opportunity would have never come through. Compartmentalizing, yes. I'm not going to say it's always the healthiest thing, but seeing the other side of it, I've often looked at tragedy like that as, worry about the things that you can control. I couldn't control what happened to my father at that point, but I could control how I reacted at it. I found my ways to manage those emotions and to allow myself to continue living on with what the trajectory of my life was going to become. It wasn't going to do anybody any good, myself or my family at the time. If I stayed home, if I just sort of like buried myself, if I turned down those opportunities, who knows what would have happened. But I saw a pathway, at least for me, that if I could change my fortunes a little bit, if you will, I can provide. I mean, at this point, I'm thinking I have to provide for my whole family, which fortunately was the case. My father was wise enough to have set up all these other investments and insurances and whatnot. But I wasn't aware of that at this point. I'm young and very naive, mind you. That was probably the biggest hurdle I had to overcome at that point. Well, ever, but.
Wow.
Sorry to hit you with something so intense right out of the gate here.
Well, no, it's meaningful because it goes to show that everyone's got something. I mean, I don't think I've ever had a guest on the show or anyone I've met whose life is just picture perfect without any challenge. I believe that if you have someone and you have a kid, say we're raising our kids, and they don't have any challenges at all, I believe that could be one of the most crippling things we could do as parents, is to do everything, remove all obstacles, make it super easy. Somewhere I heard this adage or proverb, if you take the easy way out, you're going to have a hard life, you know, or if you, easy training, hard life, hard training, easy life, you know. Yeah. And for me, I kind of look back, Shane, I think I have been training hard my entire life. And I think things are easier now as a result of that. Easier that I have inner peace, you know, I've worked as a coach and been through therapy and worked through all the hard stuff or trauma or my stuff, right? And worked hard to always get ahead in school, worked hard to stay ahead of the competition in sports, in sales, in entrepreneurship. And that's afforded some things that make it a little bit easier. So I'm with you that tragedy is something that I'm with you. Let's worry about the things we can control. You know, the tragedy is here to serve me in some way if I let it. So I'm going to stop. I can go down the rabbit hole with you here. I'm so appreciative that you shared this story because I know our listeners will resonate.
It's a normal part of life, right? And I think a lot of people are afraid to sometimes address those things. For me, it happened earlier than it's going to happen maybe for some other people. But at some point, you're going to have to deal with it and find what you can out of it to continue onwards.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not dismissing the fact that it's an emotional time. It was certainly emotional for me at the time, but figure out your way to navigate through it. And I do believe... I always tell people, whenever a friend's parent dies now, I say, you know, the thing you're going to take with you is there's not a day, and I'm not just saying this to be facetious here, there's not a day I don't think about my father. I work in technology, a skill that he passed along to me. And so you will find ways to honor the memory of that person as you overcome that tragedy. I heard somewhere once, adversity creates appreciation, and that goes from the challenges you're fighting, but then also these same tragic moments is I find myself likening back to things my father used to say to me, the way he'd yell at me, the way he'd teach me to do things, and implementing them into my life, especially now as a parent. Of course, I see that. That would be the only recommendation I would give people out there too, is just honor that memory, not by kind of lingering on the tragic aspects of it, but grab those good moments and you'll realize how much you're implementing in your own life from them.
I love that. I had a client earlier this week call me and say, man, I need to talk. And I was talking to him, and one of his best friends, 54 years old, got saddled with a cancer diagnosis, pancreatic. They caught it too late. So it was a death sentence, basically. And he died on Tuesday. You know, and I remember talking to my client who has lost a best friend, lost a brother, lost a wife's mom, lost one more cousin. So there's been four deaths in the span of about 13 months.
Wow.
And it takes a toll, even at, I'd say, at the age of my client, who's in their 50s now. You know, but I lost my dad at 28. You lost yours when you were early 20s, just the day you're getting ready to, the week of college graduation and final exams. I mean, you're there at the very last minute. So I'm curious if you go back in time a year when your father got the cancer diagnosis. I mean, what was that conversation like from your lens when the news was shared with you?
When you're that young, you're untouchable. Do you remember first getting your license and you punch the gas? Never thought you're going to get in a car accident. That's what that felt like to me. It's like, I just got cancer, no big deal. My father looks great. Father's always been healthy. He's 60. He's done everything right in his life. He quit smoking many, many years ago. He wasn't drinking anymore. Like, I mean, when they're younger, they would go out and have parties. My parents never touched alcohol for years. And they had a full-built bar in our, before we moved down to South Jersey. I mean, we had like, you'd go into a pub, a full-size bar. Our parents were known for throwing these crazy parties. We moved down here. They build a bar in the basement. My parents don't touch the booze. They'll have like drinks on like holidays and stuff, but they don't drink. They don't smoke. Like they were relatively healthy people, all things considered. And so when we get hit with the diagnosis, all right, he's got cancer. All right, well, when is this going to be over with? You're going to have to go to a couple extra doctor's appointments. And it doesn't actually hit me, honestly, until he's like being entered into hospice. And that's when it like it dawns on me that like, oh my God, this is like serious. Hospice. And of course, when you're going to hospice, I don't learn this until much later. When you're going to hospice, it is effectively the death sentence, right? They tell you and they appease it. This isn't like a permanent thing. You know, you can come out of it. No, no. That's generally not why you're going there. If they're going to be realistic with you. And that was another thing I learned early on is like, I want you to just shoot me straight because I want to know how to plan for it. Don't sugarcoat anything. This is my, for my personal health. My mother later passed, ironically, at 60 years old from cancer. And it was the same thing with hers. Appease my mother. When my mother leaves the room, I need you to tell me what I need to be anticipating here because I need to know how to plan. That's how I've taken my whole life from start to finish. That's how I look at my business. Don't sugarcoat it. If you don't like something, tell me. Because it was sugarcoated to me from with my father and it hit me like a ton of bricks. I didn't know how to react to it. I didn't know how to plan. We weren't ready for it. My mother wasn't ready for it. It was, you're in denial. You think you're invisible until you're not.
Man.
Whew.
Yeah, tough stuff, man. Tough stuff. Thank you for sharing and you know, appreciate that. Our listeners certainly appreciate it as well. I'd love to fast forward and go one more challenge. Can you share with us what's been challenging, you know, from 2012 until today? What's been something that's been challenging in your business that you've struggled with and had to overcome?
Yeah. So 2012 was probably the next big challenge, the big hurdle I had to come off. And that was honestly quitting my job, a job that's done much for me as we established. And then going into my business, it's the scariest moment of your life is to say, I'm going to turn away this guaranteed salary and I'm going to go work for myself. You don't know where the money's going to come from. You don't know if the business is going to uptick. You don't know if you're going to make it at all. I was fortunate, if you want to look at it that way, that I had no kids. I had no mortgage. I had no wife. Nobody depended on me. So it took me every single day for six straight months for me to muster up the courage. I went into work every day. Three days a week for 6 months. And I'd say, today is the day I'm resigning. Today is the day I'm resigning. And I couldn't muster up the courage to do it. Finally, my boss at the time, who again became a great mentor to me, calls an office meeting. And this is the day, I swear that this was the day I had it. I was ready. I went into his office. I'm like, I need to talk to you. He's like, hold on. I got to do an office meeting. Let's just talk after it. He says he's retiring. And I go in his office afterwards because he says, you know, oh, you wanted to talk to me. I'm like, well, you just like stole my thunder. I was going to tell you I'm resigning today. That threw a curveball because the person that was seceding him was anticipating that I would stay with the company and increase my role there. So that was really, really difficult for me to overcome. And I know as business owners, that's the scariest thing. I talked to everybody I knew, and I would encourage you to do the same if you're kind of teetering. What should you do? And a lot of the advice I had, it was twofold. One of which was, you know, find a singular focus and define what that is. Don't try to be everything of everybody. But when you finally leave your job, you don't realize how much extra time you're doing it. When it's a side hustle, you're putting in half your energy to it, right? So take that side hustle. For me, I was commuting to the city 5 hours round trip every day. I had a lot of time sitting on a train to do nothing. So I built websites and that's how I started to build a client base. Well, the clients I'm attracting when I'm working from 5 p.m. to midnight and then weekends are the same people that are working in side hustles. When I quit my job, I was making on paper significantly less. I took 2 weeks to kind of decompress and I went at it. And then all of a sudden I was getting business. Well, why is that? Because the people I'm targeting now are working from 9 to 5. This is their sole focus. And so the quality of client changed for me. And so I sat there and said to myself, like, what happened if I started this 6 months ago? Of course, you never want to look back, right? Best time to start was in the past. Second best time to start is today. Chris Van Vliet, I'll attribute that one to you. But that was hard. That was really hard. I know everybody that's an entrepreneur goes through that. Later on, from that 2012 to current period, failure is an everyday thing. I've been pretty fortunate through my educational career that I never had to pick up a book. If a teacher taught me something, it's like muscle memory for me. I just see it and I can understand it. I would never do homework. I thought it was stupid. I would go into classes. I mean, there was classes that I'd put my head down on the desk and nap. Teacher would ask me the question. I'd rattle off the answers. Like, okay, you can go back to sleep. I was really good in school. So I was not used to failure at all. And like you said before, sometimes that's a problem. And it was after my father's instances. But then when I went into business, it was the same thing. Nobody ever told me no. Nobody ever told me they didn't like it. And if they didn't, they'd sugarcoat it for me. And that's when I started to try to figure out and pull that out of people. I will never forget the day that I got punched in the gut on a business call. I went into this meeting thinking that this was a layup deal because I got recommended from a company I've been working with for quite a while. I came highly praised.
Yep.
This is a slam dunk. They had talked to me about it. And I thought that what we're going into is to talk about the vision for their site. And I went in there and there was three of them on the call. And he set the counter for 2 hours. I'm like, that must have been a mistake. We go in there and he's like, all right, go ahead. Yeah, your presentation. Like, yeah, like you're going to give a presentation on what you're going to do for our organization. I'm like, oh, I just thought we were going to talk about the website live. And then like, you know, we'll figure out what you want and maybe what we can do. He's like, no, you're going to give a presentation. So do you not have something prepared? I'm like, okay, well, I could just do this live. No problem. And I just went through it. And there's only so much you can do about looking at somebody's website and critiquing it. And then he just stops me. He's like, we know our website sucks. He's like, tell us how you're going to make it better. So then I go into like my spiel. I'm not a salesperson. I can't BS you. I'm going to tell you like it is. So that's how I want you to tell it back to me. So I give him what I think. I give him like, you know, what I think we can do, how I think we could do it, the timeline. And then he just stops me. He's like, listen, man. And he's like, I got to be honest with you right now. And I'm only going to be honest with you because you come highly recommended to us. He's like, you are bombing. At this point, I am torrentially sweating. Sweating is dripping off my face.
Whoa. Like, okay.
You are doing terrible. So I'm going to give you another opportunity here to collect yourself and go at it. Otherwise, we'll end this. So I was like, all right. So I take a minute, I take a drink of water, and I try to just like on the spot, just think up something to say to get this. We end up wrapping the whole thing up probably in 30 minutes. They had 2 hours reserved for this. I don't know what they were expecting. He asked me at the end if the requirements weren't clear. Of course, I'm not going to say no. I'm like, oh, maybe there was a misunderstanding. I went back and looked at them later. It's not what I anticipated coming into that. Within an hour, they emailed me and said they went in another direction. Totally understood it. And when I was done with that, on the call, I've never been so embarrassed in my life. He asked me, what's your core competency? I had no idea what to say. I'm like, you're asking me things like, I can't, my brain is now not functioning because I'm so nervous. And I just started laughing when I was done. I'm like, that was like, wow, like that was a major failure. I obviously lost that gig. I've never been so embarrassed in a business meeting, but I walked away from that realizing, all right, well, like I've got to structure my process now. And I've got to be able to go into these calls when something like this happens and say like, this is what we can do for you. This is what we do really well. This is how we can optimize your system. And it taught me to have these, not just for those business meetings, but to actually identify my own business. Like, what is my core competency? What do we do well for businesses? And so when you asked me at the beginning, well, what do you do for businesses? Well, that's it. It's like we go into businesses and we leverage technology to improve your operational efficiency. That's our core competency, implementing technology. I didn't know what to say on that call. It was mind-boggling, but I think I came out a better person for it. Not a better salesperson, but definitely a more aware business person.
Dude, I totally hear you. I think back to the days when I'm just sitting there drenched in sweat, trying to think about, oh my God, how am I going to get this thing closed? I'm embarrassed. What am I saying? What are they thinking? Right. I mean, I remember I felt some imposter syndrome a number of times earlier in the career in that similar scenario. So I'm white knuckling under the table. Just how do I get through this? What's the perfect question? Yeah. How do I make it happen? So thank you for sharing that story, man. I was feeling it there for a second because you think it's a layup. You've got the great referral from someone. You provided great value. And now, hey, show me your presentation. That's how it started. Oof.
What are you talking about?
Tough one.
Now I knew that calendar right for 2 hours wasn't an accident. It was intentional. And again, should have paid attention to the details, but...
Yeah, well, I think something interesting that just coming up to me right now is that when we started this conversation, like before we turned on the camera, my question to you was, I mean, how much and what can you do for my company? Because I'm in need of someone to help redesign our website and manage our IT services. And you mentioned that. And I guess when someone asks you that question, what can you do for me? Or they ask you, like, what do you do now? If you're talking to someone like me who might be a prospect, I don't know if I'm ideal or not, but I could at least be a prospect. What was the first thing or first couple things you might ask me as a prospect?
You know, for me and what I've learned over time is that with any business, you have to know what your range is, what your capacity is. And I always tried to be the yes man for everybody that came to me. If you ask me to do something, is it possible for me to do it? Most likely. Will one project take me significantly more time and resources than it's worth? Undoubtedly. So for me, I need to understand what you want, right? And again, this is just outside of my specific business. You could be a plumber, you could be a web designer, you could be a financial analyst. the message is still the same. What do you want? What do you want to get out of this? And I think that was the first thing I say to you is, I could build you a website. I could build it in my own image, but I don't necessarily understand what your goal is. If your goal is A and I'm building a website for C, then I could build you the greatest website in the world. If it doesn't accomplish what you want, then what's the point? And so that's how I try to approach things. Once I have an understanding of what the end result is supposed to look like, that allows me then to say, all right, well, can I build something that'll meet those goals? The answer is either yes, maybe, or no. The second hardest thing for me to be able to wrap my head around when I was in business is, one, not saying yes to everything was obviously the first. The second was knowing when to tell a client, we're not the right fit for you, turning down business. That's in the same instance. Sometimes the reason I want to know what the client wants or the prospective client wants is because I need to know if it's within my capacity that I'm able to dedicate those resources within a reasonable time, that it's not going to make my business look bad. All you've got in business is your reputation. In an agency like mine, and probably in most businesses, service-based especially, we're a dime a dozen. I mean, you can Google web designer and you can find them everywhere. The difference that's going to get me a job versus somebody else is, can you rely on me and am I being honest with you? And I'd rather tell somebody, listen, this is what it's going to cost me to do this. Is this in your budget? Yes or no? If the answer is yes, okay, here's the hurdles we're going to get. If it's no, here's how we can pare that down. If it's still no, I'll give you another solution to go to that's not paying me, but at least gets you something that you're online that you can get going with, the hopes that maybe you come back to me later. If it's so complex that I can't do it, but I know somebody that's going to do it, I'm happy to send the business out that way. If that's still not the case, I'll just offer myself up and say, listen, this is way outside of our skill set. I understand the technology behind it, but I don't have the team to be able to accomplish this. I'll volunteer my time for you to help you vet out other people as you go through this process. And that's the most I can offer. I don't like to keep a lock on knowledge because you can find it anywhere. I'd rather be the sole source of it. And I'd rather be honest and be able to deliver that and create some sort of a rapport and tell somebody honestly what they need or how a process is built and see what comes of that. But it's multifaceted for me. Undoubtedly though, being selective and dumping clients, as they say, has been probably the most empowering point. Because it's scary when this is your business, this is your income, and you're saying, no, I don't want your money. Well, that's you want to try to make it work, but is it worth it? And yeah. Generally, the answer is no.
Yeah, it's challenging to dump clients, if you call it that. Yeah, that's difficult. Yeah. Yeah. I remember the first time I ever came face-to-face with that, I pushed it off forever. You know, it's like when I dated a girl a long time ago, I was like, I don't want to break up with her. I ended up dating her for much longer than I wanted.
You're not doing anybody a favor.
Yeah. I didn't want to hurt her. I didn't want to hurt the client. And yeah. So to take it back a couple notches, you know, failure is an everyday thing. I mean, I think I was doing a speech yesterday and I was quoting Nelson Mandela, I never lose. I always win or I learn. And I sense a lot of that in you, Shane. You're talking about failure and you're failing every day and you're failing forward every day and you're learning every day.
Yep. I like that.
Yeah. I sense this about you. So I'm curious, where can we go to find you on social media, your website? How do we find out more and maybe get in touch with you and talk to you about serving us in some way, shape, or form?
Sure. I appreciate you asking. On socials, best place to find us is at sfxdotcom. It's sfx.com. It's all spelled out. And then if you want to head on our website, it's s-fx.com. The actual dash, not the word written out. We're posting content up there. I mean, really every day, sometimes multiple times a day. For the most part, I try to keep the salesy stuff off of my channels, probably against better judgment from people that are telling me you should probably tell people more what you do. But I try to make our channels, or at least the content on our channels, more focused on, you know, how can we be helpful in business? Here's a tip for a small business owner. Here's a tip if you want a website. Here's just a motivational talk about a quote that I heard. Because again, likening back, I'd rather you feel trust and confidence in our message that we're trying to put out there than just trying to get somebody's money.
True. Fantastic. I appreciate everything you've shared today so far. It's just been amazing. Thank you, Shane. I'd love to take you in the lightning round now and just ask you a couple parting questions.
All right.
And I've already asked you about a couple things. I've asked you about video games and wrestling. And you know, I'm curious about books. If you're a reader, then I'm curious what might be 1 to 3 books that have had an impact in your life that you'd recommend?
Not a huge reader, admittedly. But one book that changed my life was The 4-Hour Workweek by Timothy Ferriss and was the catalyst for me quitting my job. Tuesdays with Maury, if I picked out another book, was one that helped me navigate through losing my father. It's a lot about just kind of navigating emotion as somebody sort of passes away, going through that process. So those would be the two that I would recommend to anybody. I will say with The 4-Hour Workweek, people try to take it at face value. Do not. It's metaphorical. You're not going to work 4 hours, but understand the lessons that are being taught to structure your day.
Fantastic. Well, good. Well, let's go to music then. If there is a song or a genre or an artist that just lights you up, like what are your musical preferences?
I'm a sucker for 80s, especially one-hit wonders. Oh. If you're finding me out at a bar, I'm probably singing Living on a Prayer, anything by John Bon Jovi, honestly. 8675309, Tommy Two Tone, One a Classic, The Outfield, Your Love. Yeah, I mean, anything in that era. I'll listen to just about anything, but if you picked up my playlist right now, it's going to be primarily 80s songs and heavy doses of Bon Jovi.
Ah, fantastic. Living on a Prayer is one of my favorited songs on Girls Driving Spotify list. My girls love that song. So I'm with you on this one.
Greatest song of all time.
We'll give you the last word. And the last question is, the name of our show is the Eternal Optimist Podcast. What does Eternal Optimist mean to you, Shane?
You know, I thought about this a lot in listening to some of your other episodes, and I was trying to figure out how I'd answer this question. I think for me, the Eternal Optimist is being able to see through any of that adversity, any of that failure, and know that you're going to come out on the other side better. And I think it's really hard to do that. And that's why you have to sort of keep that mindset. Being an optimist is a mindset. And being an eternal optimist means that sometimes when life is just sucker punching you a lot, like you mentioned your client before, hit after hit, it is incredibly difficult to navigate through that. But there's no sense in dwelling in the past. I said before, and I'll say it again, worry about the things that you can control. And the way to do that is to keep looking forward. That's what it says to me.